Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm pleased to say we have Paul Bingham and Joanne Souza on the show, and we'll be talking about their fascinating new book, Death from a Distance and the Birth of a Humane Universe. Theories of history are out of fashion. They have been for a number of years, particularly since the collapse of Marxism. You occasionally find historians dabbling in them, but usually when you see a new theory of history, it is written by somebody other than a historian. Jared Diamond comes to mind. He is a geographer. The book under consideration today is another example and a terrific example of a modern theory of history. Paul Bingham and Joanne Souza have constructed a way to think about the development of humanity from the evolution of Homo sapiens some 2 million years ago to the present, one that makes sense of a lot of what we see in the historical record and reduces it, if I might say, to a number of reasonably simple and elegant rules. These rules involve the costs of policing and the results of decreases in those costs for social evolution. This is really the kind of book I think that every historian should read, especially historians who are interested in world history. It offers not only a description, historians are very good at description, but an explanation of what we see in the historical record. In any event, I really enjoyed talking to Paul and Joanne today, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Paul and Joanne.
Hello, Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you guys today?
Doing very well. It's a beautiful day here.
I'm glad to hear that. You're in Stony Brook, New York. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, I'm glad to hear the weather's good. We're having a wonderful spring here in Iowa today. It's very nice. My son gets to play outside, and my daughter, so they're happy about that. No more winter. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Paul Bingham and Joanne Souza about their really interesting, challenging new book, Death from a Distance and the Birth of a Humane Universe. The book is really a theory of history, and as I was telling them in the pre-interview, theories of history are a little bit out of fashion these days among historians. I think that's really too bad. This is a particularly good one. It's very challenging, and I recommend that everyone who's interested in big history or long-term history or wants an explanation, what biologists sometimes call an ultimate explanation of why things have turned out the way they have turned out, I think that everyone that's interested in that question should read the book. I know that I enjoyed it very, very much, and I just want to thank the authors for writing it. And I also want to thank a listener to the show for bringing it to my attention. I had read Paul's work years ago on this issue, and I was very happy to see that a book had come out. You can find a link to the book's website on New Books in History, and I, again, encourage you to go there. Paul and Joanne, why don't we begin the interview by having you tell us a little bit about yourselves. Let's go in reverse order now. Joanne, why don't you begin?
Okay. I grew up on Long Island, and I did exceptionally well in school, but I loved horses and loved animals, so I needed to support my love of animals. Therefore, I started to work very early in life. So I've worked in all types of institutions, large and small. I've worked in public institutions, federal, state. I've worked in small companies and in large. And I went to work for AT&T eventually and was lucky enough to, I guess you can call it lucky enough to live through divestiture, where I watched the company go from under the Public Service Commission to something that became basically a free-for-all at the time. But what I noticed was that I'm very interested in human health and in stress. And what I noticed that a lot of the institutions that people actually work in don't serve their interests at all. And I wanted to understand why. I wanted to understand what the problem was. So I basically gave everything up and came back into academia, looking into the social sciences, into social psychology, to see if I could find some answers. In other words, I could describe how people would behave. I could describe the stress that they would undergo, but I couldn't understand cause and effect at all. So I came back into academia, looked into the social sciences. I did not find my answers there. I found out that they were just as descriptive as my, basically as my experience. So I backed up into evolutionary biology to find out the underlying cause of human social behavior. And that's basically when I met Paul.
Yeah. Well, your story's a little bit like mine, except I went through Russian history. Go ahead, Paul.
the meeting of the two of us is actually, of course, going to be the key event in both of these biographies. So I actually grew up not far from you, Marshall, in the rural Midwest near Champaign-Urbana.
Really?
Yeah, and I went to undergraduate school in a small private school near St. Louis called Blackburn College.
Uh-huh.
But then I went on to do a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology at Harvard. I started in the mid-70s, so I'm over 50, shall we say. And at that point, the sort of cutting edge of the intellectual excitement in the sciences was molecular biology. Mm-hmm. This was at the pinnacle of the molecular revolution, and I wanted to be a part of it. And so I did my PhD at Harvard in that subject. But I'd always had an interest in human social behavior and an awareness that we didn't understand it very well. And it was my good fortune that Ed Wilson published Sociobiology literally the year I came to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to know Ed, and I got to know Steve Gould and Bob Trivers and the guys across Divinity Avenue from me who were thinking simply about the evolution of human social behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on. I spent the rest of my career working on biochemistry and molecular biology and cell biology, and I continue to do that. But this has been a second interest, the evolution of human social behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it grew in the 90s into a full-blown second interest, co-equal with my interest in molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
And I pursued it, and I had the good fortune to meet Joanne about 10 years ago, and we recognized that we had highly confluent interests, and we spent the last decade building and testing and refining a new theory of human behavior, including a theory of history, and of course that's the subject of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a terrific story. You know, historians very rarely work with anyone but themselves, and I sometimes feel like that's a bad thing. I told you I do a lot. I did biology as an undergraduate, and as well as history, and I remember very clearly being influenced by sociobiology and thinking it was a really quite an interesting way to explain certain human behaviors, or at least putatively explain certain human behaviors. Then when I got to graduate school in history, I was told that was not something a historian should think about, and that was genetic determinism, and you shouldn't – yes, that was – yeah. I remember Nazis being mentioned a lot. The historians are very afraid of this kind of thing, and I'm here to say that they shouldn't be, because I having worked in this field for many years now, I've never met a Nazi, not one. So they're all very well-intentioned people, such as yourself. So why don't you tell us how you came to write this book? I guess it goes even deeper than that, how you evolved the theory.
Okay, so let me start off, and Joanne will pick up, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So what the subject of the book is a fundamentally new theory of the evolutionary logic of human social behavior. Let me emphasize that we've gone far beyond sociobiology and evolutionary psychology. We have taken off into a completely new level of understanding, we argue in the book. And the fundamental theory is that the conflict of interest problem limits all social cooperation in all animals at all times. And humans are different than other animals for a single reason. Because we control conflicts of interest, we manage them, we keep them from interfering with our social cooperation in a way that non-human animals have never done before. And in so doing, that gives us, it turns out, a theory of language evolution, a theory of the evolution of our cognitive virtuosity. We can discuss those things later if you like.
But I would. Yes, go ahead.
But of equal interest is that it gives us a theory of history of completely unprecedented scope. And I'll briefly summarize that theory for you in a moment. But let me emphasize that historian skepticism of what's sometimes called grand theory is a little like a 15th century astronomer being skeptical because Ptolemaic astronomy for 2,000 years has failed.
Mm-hmm.
If grand theory fails because we haven't had the right one. Mm-hmm. When Copernican and Newtonian mechanics comes along, suddenly we have the right one, and grand theory looks a lot more promising. In fact, we would argue from the natural sciences that any good theory turns out to be a grand theory because
mm-hmm.
they turn out to be a very powerful and predictive and parsimonious.
Mm-hmm.
And we argue that that's what we have.
Mm-hmm.
So let me try to capsulize the theory for you. And then
okay, great.
So the argument is that humans are the first animals to have access to inexpensive coercive threat. We're the first animals for whom law enforcement is a Darwinian adaptation. Hence, and we have access to that because of our ability to project threat from a distance, hence the phrase death from a distance in the title. As a result of inexpensive law enforcement, our ability to cooperate with non-kin, I'm sure you're aware non-human animals cooperate with kin. Human animals cooperate also with non-kin.
Mm-hmm.
Our ability to cooperate with non-kin, with whom we have conflicts of interest, depends on our ability to inexpensively manage the conflict of interest problem.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that, we're genetically designed to be cultural creatures, by the way. So this theory is not genetically deterministic in the kind of trivial sense. We are first and foremost cultural creatures. It is our biological heritage.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that's important, though, is that the scale of our adaptive sophistication, including our ability even to understand ourselves and certainly to manipulate our environment, is determined by the scale of our social cooperation, because that in turn determines the magnitude of the stream of cultural information that informs our behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So one last piece, and then we have a theory of history. The scale of our social cooperation is determined by the scale at which we can apply this 2-million-year-old trick of coercive suppression of conflicts of interest.
Mm-hmm.
That, in turn, is determined by the coercive threat that we can project, which, of course, is limited by the weapons technology to which we have access.
Mm-hmm.
So humans use weapons not primarily for mayhem and violence, but primarily for enforcement of cooperation,
mm-hmm.
for law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
From that theory emerges a theory of the agricultural revolutions, the rise of the state, even the rise of the contemporary pan-global human village as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent summary, Joanne. Do you have anything to add to that before I launch off on some questions?
Sure. What I would like to say is that without understanding this management of conflicts of interest, we tend to make one of two mistakes. We either think that humans are just like other animals and we've just evolved to a certain higher degree of intelligence, or we tend to think that we're very different from other animals and just get over it and we don't understand why that difference exists. So in order to understand exactly where we are different and where we are not, we need to understand what the evolutionary logic was that produced an animal like us under the rules of natural selection.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, that's a good point as well. I think we can all agree that things are the way they are largely because of natural selection. I hope we can all pretty much agree on that. There are some subtleties there from population biology and phylogenetics, but let's just agree that natural selection does most of the work. So let me ask a couple of questions that I think the listeners will have about the theory. One is, since it is a theory of the evolution of cooperation, and one of the empirical premises that you forward is that humans are kind of uniquely able to solve these conflicts of interest and therefore are able to develop very complex cooperation, somebody might want to know what you have to say about, let's say, the eusocial insects, bees and ants and wasps.
That's a great example. And, of course, being a informal protege of Ed Wilson,
yeah, that's an easy one. I'm sorry. But
Ed may not want to admit to my being his protege, by the way, so let me inflict that on him. There are two levels to the eusocial insects. The first, of course, is the straightforward kin selection. So these large colonies tend to be massive nuclear families to a first approximation. And, of course, kin selection we understand very well. The unit of interest in biology is not the individual. It's the genetic design information that builds the individual. And even Darwin implicitly recognized that. That's kind of easy. But there's another interesting level to the eusocial insects. I don't know whether you're familiar with the work or not, but there's something called worker policing.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the ants, the hymenopterans, ants and bees, the workers can actually lay eggs, unfertilized eggs. And in a hymenopteran, because of the way their chromosome mechanics works, those unfertilized eggs are sons, perfectly good sons. And those sons are more closely related to them than their brothers are, that is, the queen's male eggs. So they have an incentive to raise their sons instead of their brothers. They don't. The reason they don't is that their sisters eat those eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Called worker policing. They suppress reproduction by the kin-selected reproduction by the workers, forcing the workers to raise their brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, eusocial insects include both kin selection and a tiny, tiny amount of coercive suppression of conflicts of interest, mm-hmm. enforcing a higher level of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, we should probably explain what kin selection is for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure that many listeners do. Kin selection, you can think of it very simply as favoring those who are genetically like yourself. I don't know if there's probably a better formulation, but that's a quick
probably
and dirty one.
You'd probably have to say close kin. It's very important that close kin, it's mother, father,
sure.
brother, sister,
yeah.
offspring.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
You get past that, you'll see genetic relatedness drops like a stone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So let me ask another question. I know one of the premises of the book is that the initial leap, so to say, into very complex forms of cooperation had to do with, as you say in the theory, the appearance of a a new weapon system, one that allowed humans to inexpensively police one another through violent means, or at least the threat of violence. This was really the key component in the evolution of all of these genetically based policing designs. And that evolutionary moment has to do with our ability to throw. And I think for many people, this is going to be very counterintuitive because we don't think of throwing as anything unusual. But maybe you could talk about the very strange morphology of human throwing, and it's I think the word that you use is virtuosity of it. And right. there's a sentence in the book I think that's something like we throw like birds fly or something like this. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's the crucial point. First of all, your premise is correct. That we argue is the first domino. The evolution of elite throwing leads to everything else that makes us human. And again, we can explore that in more detail in a moment. But I'm sorry, Joanne had something to add.
I just wanted to clarify one thing, that to make sure that people understand that what we're saying is that once you cut off the best available option, which basically would be kin-selected behavior, then cooperation can emerge at the next scale.
Mm-hmm.
So but what happens is the person is taking now, or the organism is taking the next available option when the best self-interested strategy is cut off.
Mm-hmm.
So then now to come back to throwing, throwing is what lets us cut off that alternative option, the equivalent of worker policing in the social insects, except now on a vast new scale. So yes, yeah, so if you look at humans, so if you watch an American baseball game, people do things out on the diamond that even our closest living relatives, chimps, cannot do. So in fact, Joanne and I show a video clip to an undergraduate course that we teach, and it produces one of the biggest laughs of the semester when we just show them chimps throwing. They are goofily incompetent at it. Yeah, they are. Even though they're powerful animals, they can rip your arm off. They are powerful animals, but they throw in a way that's just absurdly funny to us because we throw with elite sophistication. Another line we use in the book is that humans throw the way dolphins swim and the way cheetahs run.
Mm-hmm.
Our bodies have been redesigned to throw with elite skill. So if you list the things that make humans unique, you know, you think of speech and large brains, but elite throwing is another of those things. And it's easy, in fact, to pinpoint all the different skeletal adaptations in us compared to our non-human Australopithecus ancestors that make us such good throwers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My wife is a mathematician, and she likes to give the example in her calculus classes of throwing a stick to a dog. And she'll say, look, the dog is solving a calculus problem on the fly. And I'm like, well, I can do that.
Yeah.
I can do that with a baseball. I did it for years. Yeah, and much more accurately than the dog. But it is true. I mean, the degree of sophistication in human throwing, the ability to hit something with a small object at really a pretty significant distance is something that no other species can come even close to, which isn't to say that they don't have their own virtuosities, but this is one that I believe is unique in the animal kingdom. So explain how that gets us, how that itself evolved.
Well, so we think that, so remember that natural selection has no foresight.
Mm-hmm.
So it cannot say, okay, let's build a human that throws with elite skill so that we can evolve kinship independent social
mm-hmm.
cooperation. So, in fact, we believe that elite throwing probably evolved in the context of a power scavenging or hunting adaptation. Power scavenging is easy to think about. So in a fragmented African landscape of 2 million years ago, hypothetically, an Australopithecus population found itself in a refugium, a savanna refugium, where the big heavyweight social hunters like lions and hyenas were not, but lightweight solitary speed hunters, say like cheetahs and leopards, were. That opens a really interesting opportunity. You let that speed hunter bring down a prey. You let it feed a little bit so it's not too hungry. And then you chase it off the prey and take it.
Mm-hmm.
That's called power scavenging.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of scenario would select for elite throwing in an animal that throws poorly the way chimps do. Chimps throw poorly, but their throwing is not so completely incompetent that they could not scare a well-fed and indolent solitary speed hunter off its prey. Remember that if a speed hunter's leg is broken or its teeth are shattered, it's dead. There are
mm-hmm.
no cheetah hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So if that adaptation arises, then there will be very strong selection for animals to get better and better and better at throwing in order to hunt or scavenge better.
Mm-hmm.
That then produces an elite thrower, and of course natural selection will then start experimenting with elite throwing to find out what else it, speaking metaphorically, what else it can lead to, and in fact it leads to kinship independent cooperation, we
mm-hmm.
argue.
Mm-hmm. Do we have, since all primates that existed between 6 and 2 million years ago were roughly in the same ecological context, do we have any fossil evidence of any other early primates who developed this that did not make it to the present, that is, extinct hominins? If you understand the question.
I do, and nothing decisive. The only reason I hesitate is that you could take certain scraps and interpret them that way, but the simplest interpretation of the evidence, Marshall, is that there were multiple Australopithecus species, hominins, or hominids, using the older term, in Africa at this time, probably at least two and maybe three or four lineages. One of the lineages underwent the process we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, in fact, a great deal of both archaeological and fossil evidence that that happens, and we can come back to that in a moment, if you like. The other Australopithecus lineages went about their own business, and in fact, non-human Australopithecus coexisted with early Homo up until about a million years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I just was wondering, because, you know, there are these, you know, evolutionary, I guess, What is the word that you use for it? I can't really remember, where a similar sort of trait is developed by multiple species in a lineage. And one might think that elite throwing would be one of those, and it may have.
If so, one of the lineages took off and displaced the others,
yes,
the way we're about to drive chimps to extinction.
Yeah, displace. That's such a nice term. I want to keep displace and not murder. No, move on just a little bit, and let's make the connection between elite throwing and the development of non-kin cooperation. And I was hoping that you would particularly talk about what we might call the personal economics of engaging in violence with others of your kind.
Okay, I'd like to make one point too.
Oh yeah, go ahead, Joanne.
When we talk about in other words, this power scavenging, this would take into consideration that humans could run, because you would be looking to chase down that cheater and keep up with it. However, the running in itself doesn't manage the conflicts of interest problem between non-kin at all. So what we're saying is that if two animals fight up close, in other words, it's what we call proximal killing, the chances of your getting hurt individually are very high. So in that case, a bigger, stronger animal would win. So that's where you get your dominance hierarchy coming into play. However, if you have an animal that can project threat from a distance, what ends up happening is the chances of any individual in a group that would try to chase off the cheater gets hurt falls drastically.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you had a group of animals, a group of kin animals, chase down a kill, and then they chased off the cheetah, say, and then another animal came in and tried to take it from them, what they could easily do is project threat. In other words, they could take those rocks and they could throw it at the person or the animal, mm-hmm, that tried to take the kill from them.
And then this lowers the risk of incurring some sort of personal injury non-linearly, so to say. In other words, it really drastically lowers the risk of being,
correct,
hurt. Yes. And I think that's intuitive. It should be intuitive to anyone who's ever seen a fight between humans, that is something like a bar fight, a no-holds-barred kind of bar fight, because, you're going to get hurt. Even the winner comes out in pretty bad shape in a bar fight. And oftentimes the little guy does beat up the big guy. Probably in the majority of cases, the big guy wins. Mass is important. But grappling with somebody is a really dangerous thing. I mean, every fight I've ever seen, and I've seen a few, have always ended up as a wrestling match, and those are particularly bad news. So you are very likely to be hurt. But so what you're saying is, if you have a kind of what military strategists call a standoff weapon, you can actually you don't have to really defend yourself because you are at a distance. And the analogy that comes to mind is you don't want to bring a knife to a gunfight.
That's exactly right.
Correct.
A knife fight and a firing squad are fundamentally different things.
Yeah, they are. I tell you what, they really are. So then the notion is that humans started to use this ability that they had developed in scavenging to police one another as they became more cooperative. Is that correct?
That's correct. So that, in effect, what happens is that if multiple individuals can simultaneously project threat against a single individual, they can very inexpensively, in other words, they're acting as a firing squad, not as a individual knife fighter, they can very inexpensively ostracize those individuals who do not want to conform to the consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And the personal economics that you alluded to a moment ago are that your risks in projecting threat from a distance go down as the square of your numerical advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are five of you ostracizing a single free rider, your risks are 25-fold lower, not mm-hmm. 5-fold lower, than they would be if you were trying to ostracize them as a single individual.
Mm-hmm.
That extreme catastrophic reduction in risk then makes the benefits, the secondary benefits of law enforcement, very attractive because its costs are low and its benefits are significant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, where this non-kin cooperation comes in is that if a non-kin cooperator, now their best available option is to join the cooperative hunt
mm-hmm.
if they wish to eat.
Mm-hmm. Because it becomes extremely expensive not to join.
Excuse me?
It becomes extremely expensive not to join.
Right.
Yes,
So you don't eat, and in this case, you don't just steal it. Now you have to contribute to creating it in the first place.
Uh-huh. I see what you mean. Yeah. So let me ask a couple of questions that you deal with very well in the book, but I think the readers will be interested in them. One is, what about a case in which, I'm thinking of like an ambush where a bunch of primates jump one another. They do this. We've seen this. We see this in chimpanzees. Why doesn't that efficiently lower the cost of policing?
Right. So I think there's two levels to that answer. First of all, humans can project threat with lethal effect out to about 10 meters. That means you can put 100 humans on a single target.
Mm-hmm.
100 squared is 10,000 fold. That is an enormous effect. And it's those kinds of depressions in cost that are probably really evolutionarily important. In other words, putting two or three individuals on a target buys you a 9-fold effect. Putting 100-fold on a target buys you a 10,000-fold effect.
Mm-hmm.
That having been said, a lot of the free riding in non-human animal social behavior is executed not by a single individual, but by close kin, say two or three brothers or sisters. So if you're going to ostracize free riders, you have to ostracize a small group of tightly knit individuals
mm-hmm.
who will tend to fight back to back. So ambushing three individuals with three other individuals ends up being a knife fight, not a firing squad,
mm-hmm.
to put it simply.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of short answer. I think if you look at non-human animal coercion, chimps, for example, will occasionally put two or three individuals on an isolated target, but individuals will conspire to avoid being that target, including hanging around with their close kin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually, I think I experienced that in high school. The Williams brothers.
Absolutely.
Don't mess with them.
All been there.
Yeah. I see just what you mean. So I asked you a question over email, and I was interested to hear your response. The question was this. Why isn't the case that prior to the evolution of elite throwing of this missile projection virtuosity, wasn't it the case that the cost of punishing people wasn't already very low? People of hominins, very, very low because they sleep, and you can kill anyone in their sleep pretty easily, especially if you have some sort of weighty object in your hand. And we know that hominins had them a couple of million years ago.
Yeah, we think we have a pretty good grasp of why that doesn't work. The first thing to remember is that the strategy has to be a recurrently effective strategy year after year for tens of thousands of years to allow the evolution of a systematic adaptation in response to it. But as biologists, and Joanne has vast experience also, as I do, with non-human animals, their sleep behavior evolves to their risk environment. So if they're at very high risk of predation or, for that matter, of conspecific violence, as you're proposing,
mm-hmm.
then they evolve either to sleep lightly, so they're very difficult to approach, or to sleep in fortified locations. So even chimps, for example, tend to build leaf nests in trees, making it very difficult to approach them without making a big racket.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the strategy of consistently being able to kill someone at will in his or her sleep may not be very realistic. There's another issue, though. If you can stay awake and catch an animal in its sleep, an animal can feign sleep and destroy you as you approach.
Yeah.
So as a consistent strategy for inexpensive coercive threat, it's probably not very workable. But let's make the worst-case assumption for our theory and assume that you could kind of make it work in some way or another. You are, again, though, enforcing the law in a knife fight. That is, you're approaching as one or two individuals, one other individual. If they happen to be feigning sleep and counterattack, all the risks of law enforcement are on you. And that your acts of law enforcement then become altruistic acts, literally genetically altruistic acts. Natural selection never, ever selects consistently for genetically altruistic acts.
Mm-hmm.
The benefits of your ostracism go to everybody. The costs all go to you. The virtue of being able to kill from a distance is that the same people who benefit from ostracism pay its costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people, and I think part of the problem is people need to understand that the behavior that we see today, or that we'll see in the current environment, is the successful behavior from the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were designed in the Pleistocene, so to say. Design is probably too strong a word.
Counter-strategy back.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. Let's talk just for a second, because I don't think most people know. Why is it the case, and again, this goes right back to Trivers and these folks, why is it the case that natural selection can never select for altruism?
Well, of course, we have to be sure we're agreeing on what the definition of altruism is. And, of course, what we mean by that is that you commit an act that imposes a cost on your probability of survival or your reproductive output that does not pay returns in terms of increasing either your reproductive output or the reproductive output of very close kin, siblings, parents, offspring. So that's a formal definition of altruism. There's a whole body of thought that argues that humans are unique in that we have evolved to engage in exactly such altruism. We argue that that is fundamentally wrong, that humans have evolved to cooperate in pursuant of confluent self-interest, not as a result of engaging in public altruism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a very, very important point, and it marked a kind of revolution in thinking about social behavior, because for a long time people used altruism in a kind of, I guess I would say, naive, atheoretical sense. But after Hamilton and, I guess, Trivers, then we started to think about it in a new way. Actually, it's funny, there's a line that I still remember in, I guess it was Trivers' paper on reciprocal altruism, that the point of the biology of altruism is to remove the altruism from altruism, which I thought that's exactly right.
That's
very clever guy, that guy Trivers. So in any event, let's make another thing clear that I don't think most historians at least will know about, and that is the degree to which human social behavior is more cooperative than any species at all and any species closely related to us. And in order to understand that, I think the best way to do it would be to talk a little bit about chimpanzee groups.
Right.
Okay.
So let me give you a sort of aphoristic answer, and then let's talk about chimps. So the aphoristic answer is that humans and non-humans alike engage in kin-selective behavior. So human behavior in a nuclear family is very much like non-human behavior in a nuclear family. What's unique about us is that we have what we think of as our public lives, as a public domain. Non-human animals essentially have no public domain. They have no domain in which they systematically interact with other non-kin adults in a cooperative way. They do not. So if we look at chimps, for example, the core of a chimp troop is a group of males who are either kin or potentially kin, and that's important to recognize. Natural selection plays the odds. So occasionally males who are potentially kin but not actually kin will behave as if they are kin because they're playing the odds and have no way of telling whether they're actually kin or not.
Mm-hmm.
So chimp troops are built around a core of close kin males who cooperate in a kin-selected fashion to do various things, including repelling attacks by other troops. But they also tend to police the social behavior of the non-kin females who are their adult mates. And we can talk about that in detail if you like, but it gets a little esoteric at that point. The crucial point here is that animal troops are built around the core of kin adults. So lion prides and monkey troops are built around cores of kin females, chimps around cores of kin males.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to say. Sorry, Joanne, did you want to add something to that?
I did. What I wanted to say was sometimes I think some of the confusion comes in some of these artificial environments that we put these animals in. In other words, you can put a group of chimps together, and it's interesting to understand how natural selection builds minds. In other words, it builds minds to understand what was successful in the evolutionary past. So if you put a non-related chimps together in an artificial environment, they actually will act as if they are related because that's the way their minds were built to perceive their world.
Mm-hmm.
It's an artificial situation.
It's an artificial situation.
And they're behaving anomalously in a way that does not really reflect the evolutionary logic of the behavior itself.
So they actually would act as if they were related.
Yeah.
So that's important to understand when we start to look at some of the research on these non-human animals, especially chimpanzees.
Right.
That happens to me every time I go see a weepy movie. If you know what I mean, I'm put in an environment where my brain says, this is really very sad, and I think it's celluloid.
That's exactly right.
But the interesting part is, you know, it may look like non-kin cooperation in the short term. However, if we left these animals to the natural environment again, without the ability to manage the conflict of interest problem between non-kin, they would quickly revert to what to kin-selected behavior.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's important to give a very concrete example to people about what we mean by cooperation.
And I remember years ago when I first started to read about chimpanzee troops, you know, take the most basic form of human cooperation, and that is sharing food. Chimpanzees don't really share food, even really at all. I mean, we've seen maybe some of it in some context, but they don't even share food. So this degree of really asociality from our perspective is profound. It's really almost black and white. They shade into one another, I suppose, depending on where you, you know, make your distinctions and put your markers. But I remember thinking, you know, it's similar with what people say about chimpanzees and speech. Chimpanzees can't talk at all. They just can't. And, you know, behavioral psychologists and primatologists have tortured these chimps for years and years trying to get them to say anything, and they just can't. They don't have the mental architecture to do it. Similarly, I think with this kind of non-kin cooperation, they just don't have the mental architecture to do it. Let's move on actually pretty quickly. We're about halfway through here. So to the theory of history itself, because I think that's the part that will most interest the listeners. So we have this first moment where the predisposition, if we can call it that, to cooperate in a profoundly new way is born of the ability to engage in low-cost policing. So that's how we're sort of programmed, if I can use that dangerous metaphor, to cooperate in this way. But our first groups were actually quite small, and they get larger over history, and they also change a little bit. And that really is the meat of the historical theory. So let's move from elite throwing to the next weapon system, if we could.
Okay, absolutely. So elite throwing then produces this environment you just alluded to, where cooperation is extended to groups, say, of tens to hundreds. Our language, our ethical psychology, our brain expansion all evolve in that environment. But no new weapons are invented during that first time, about 1.7 million years roughly, from the origin of throwing and the first members of Homo until the next revolution. There is then the first fundamentally new coercive weapon invented is the otlal, or the spear thrower, which dramatically extends the range at which we can project lethal threat, probably about fivefold, maybe even tenfold, from thrown stones. That happens in a small East African population somewhere around 50 to 45,000 years ago. That same population is ancestral now, as a matter of genetic fact, to every human alive on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Population quickly starts to expand. It grows out of Africa, spreads across Eurasia, driving existing hominids, including the Neanderthals, to extinction, and skips the Wallace line and the polar ice cap and brings hominids to Australia and the New World for the first time. That's our theory would predict that. The scale at which we can suppress conflict of interest has increased. The scale of our social cooperation goes up. We start being able to specialize on a whole new scale. We have a vast expansion of cultural repertoire, and our capabilities therefore increase, producing what is sometimes called the behaviorally modern human revolution.
Joanne, do you want to add something to that?
The only thing I would add is that it's important to remember that the internal law enforcement is what we're talking about within a social group. In other words, the more people or the more animals that can cooperate with each other, and they also know that their interests are protected, which is where the internal law enforcement comes in. That means that they're free then to trade with each other and not be afraid of exploitation. And that's what this internal weapon does. So the degree of adaptive sophistication and specialization, as Paul said, can increase.
I see.
We are the economic and the pedagogical animal for exactly these reasons, because we can police the exchange of goods and of information.
I see. So the key variables, if I could be a little bit reductive and model this, for the impact of these weapon systems on the size of human cooperation are range and perhaps destructive power. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And opportunity cost. How much time it would take for law enforcement versus time taken away for other behavior.
Uh-huh. Maybe so you could. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, sorry. There are some subtle secondary issues, as Joanne mentioned, opportunity cost. But yes, to a crude first approximation range, and the range at which you can project lethal threat is the issue. Yeah.
That's my middle name, to a crude first approximation. That's what I'm all about.
That's what we began to understand.
Right? Yeah. So you maybe you could explain a little bit I always pronounced it addle-addle, but it's oddle-oddle. Maybe you could explain what that is for those who don't know.
Okay, so it's a spear thrower. In fact, otlottl, so it's pronounced, even though it's A-T-L-A-T-L, it's pronounced as if it were A-T-L-A-T-L.
Okay.
It's actually an Aztec word, because the first time Europeans recognized this weapon is when the Aztecs were killing the conquistadors with it.
Mm-hmm.
But the otlottl went actually everywhere around the world. So Australian Aborigines, for example, had it at European contact. It went everywhere with people, behaviorally modern humans, everywhere they went. It is essentially a throwing stick, which sounds kind of deceptively unimportant. But you hold it, there's an illustration in the book of how it works. But you hold it in your hand. It's about maybe a foot and a half long.
Yeah.
And you, at the end of that stick is a hook in which is embedded the end of a large arrow-like bolt. And you go through the normal elite human throwing motion, but at the end, when your hand whips forward, normally throwing a baseball, say, with your two fingers, you're now throwing this sharp spear with a foot and a half extension of your hand, which gives you vast increase in velocity. So that bolt leaves fastball leaves your hand if you're really good, say at 90 to 95 miles an hour. This bolt will leave the otlottl at 130, 140, 150 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And a really skilled person can actually put one of these bolts entirely through a human body. It's a very lethal weapon.
Mm-hmm. I see. And as you say, we find these all over the world. Wherever these early modern humans migrated, they brought with them this weapon.
They did indeed. So, for example, you may be aware of the early pre-modern cultures in North America, the ones that are associated with the early mammoth hunting and so on. Those so-called fulsome points and other kinds of points, those are, in fact, otlottl dart points. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This weapon is everywhere modern humans go from the very beginning. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some...
It's eventually displaced by the bow. So we think of native North Americans as bow-armed. But that's fairly recent. They were otlottl armed throughout most of their history.
I was going to say there's some great pictures in the book of you guys experimenting with these things.
It's fun. We're not very good at it, but it's fun to do.
It made me want to go do it. I don't know if we can. Here in Iowa, it's probably illegal. But I don't know if it is or not. But anyway, so let me. This increases the level of human cooperation somewhat, and it corresponds roughly with what we call the Neolithic Revolution. Is that right?
No, so the otlottl is the behaviorally modern human revolution.
Okay.
The Neolithic revolutions in Eurasia and North America are produced by the next weapon, the bow.
Okay, all right. Let's get to the bow then.
Okay, this is where the importance of opportunity cost comes in, because the bow is much easier to use. In other words, a few minutes of it's harder to make, but it's easier to use. So in order to be really good at law enforcement, the bow is easier and more democratically available to more people. So if you can have law enforcement on an everyday basis, people can then settle down and have sedentary settlements. Because people don't understand that that's what the problem is as far as sedentary settlements, is you need to have policing within those settlements. And that's what the bow gives you.
Mm-hmm. It gives you cost-effective
policing. On an everyday basis. Now you can have durable goods. You can create and grow more than just for your family's subsistence, because now you can protect what you need to trade internally, and then you can have a good economic system within the group that is protected by the bow.
Mm-hmm. I see. So we'll come back to the bow in just a second, but before we do, there's a question that I'm sure a lot of historians are going to be interested in. Doesn't your theory require, and I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it for the listeners, a theory of innovation as well? In other words, why do these things appear when and where they appear? And the things I'm talking about are all of those new and more effective weapons after elite throwing. That is the addle-addle, the bow and arrow, and so on and so forth. Why do they appear where they appear when they appear?
It does indeed. So there's, first of all, there is a stochastic element to this, to their appearance. But we know something about the appearance of several of these weapon systems. And then, of course, as we get into the modern era, we know a lot. But let's talk about what we know about the bow and the Outlawtl. It looks like the Outlawtl was developed as a specialized hunting weapon. This is the characteristic pattern. Just as with elite throwing, it didn't evolve in order to support law enforcement. It evolved for a different purpose. And then humans immediately apply it to law enforcement whenever you give it a new weapon to them.
That works.
That works, right. So the Outlawtl appears to have been invented along the African coast for hunting things like sea lions, things like that, animals that are a little hard to get at. And one local culture apparently refined the weapon to the point that it got to be really a very effective weapon, and that is the population that ultimately produced the behaviorally modern human revolution. The bow is a little less clear. It originates somewhere in the Middle East or North Africa. It probably was originally developed to hunt small mobile game, say large birds or small rodents, rabbits, things like that. It's not clear. But again, what is really required is that there's some immediate self-interested incentive to develop a new weapon for some immediate purpose. You don't develop it in order to go and create a new scale of civilization. It's, mm-hmm. it's developed for some other reason, and then humans turn around and deploy it in order to suppress conflicts of interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then that does produce a certain stochastic a feature to this. But the scale of human social innovation or human technical innovation is sensitive to the scale of our social cooperation. So, of course, this is autocatalytic. Mm-hmm. As our cultures grow, the rate at which new weapons come keeps increasing.
Yeah, this is
I would almost add something to that. You know, before you talked about humans throwing like a dolphin swims, we can really say once this process began, humans started to manage conflicts of interest the way a dolphin would swim.
Well, we've been doing that.
In other words, we're very good at it, and when a new weapon comes into our hands that can be used to manage conflicts of interest, it wasn't developed for that purpose, but when it's in our hands, we use it that way.
Mm-hmm. We continue to do that. So you can argue that Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin were doing that in 1945 with aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, I see what you mean. I think it's important to take a step back and dwell a moment on this notion that Paul mentioned about the process of increases in the rate of innovation and the growth of population having an autocatalytic relation to one another. Can you explain that a little bit? This is an important point.
It is indeed. So let me divide it into two subsidiary points, which I think together make the larger point. So we, all of us, tend to be rather conceited about our individual intelligence, and so we tend to think that individual human intelligence is the crucial variable in history. It's mostly not. It doesn't matter how smart we are. As isolated individuals, we're powerless, ineffectual, and ignorant. What really gives us power is the sharing of expertise and information. And our intelligence is fundamentally limited by that. So as the scale of our social cooperation increases, our ability to do things increases concomitantly, or maybe even exponentially. But so what that means then, and that's the first point, the second point is that each new weapon invented in the ways that we discussed a moment ago increases the scale of that enterprise, giving us access to vast new repositories of individual expertise and shared knowledge. That then will make the invention of the next weapon much faster than it would otherwise have been.
Mm-hmm.
We're now at the point, of course, these days where we're inventing spectacularly new weapons on an almost yearly basis. Precision munitions in the last decade, for example, mm-hmm. are a spectacular innovation in global projection of threat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, John.
And specialization would result as an effect of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I was very surprised by, there's an economic literature on this as well, and they build an extraordinarily simple model, who they is, I really can't be very specific about because I've forgotten all their names,
that concerns the number of people alive and the rate of innovation. And what they show is that these things are more or less linearly related. And also, interestingly, geneticists have a similar sort of linear relation between the number of exemplars in a species, that is the size of all the populations, wherever they might be, and the amount of genetic diversity which appears under, let's say, light constraints, that is very light selective constraints. So, you know, there's a lot of genetic, just numerically, a lot of genetic variation in the world today because there are 6 billion people.
Right.
Yeah, there's a huge experiment going on. We don't know about it, and there's very little selective pressure, but it's going on right now. This is something that they pointed out. And there's something a little bit compelling about this because it does remove this notion that somehow it takes a genius to do these things. It may take a genius, it's just we have a lot more geniuses. I guess I'd put it that way.
Well, I think so. The cult of the genius, you know, you, Einstein, Darwin, whatever your model is, it's partly, of course, a fable constructed by institutions to explain their ineffectuality. I mean, it's striking that Darwin was a gentleman farmer and Einstein was a patent clerk.
Yeah.
Right? That's telling you something about institutions. And so academic institutions have to kind of explain that away, and the cult of the genius is a convenient way to do that. But I think that's a second, that's a conversation for another day.
And I think the genius is also part of coming out of the archaic state.
I like to tell people that I run here at the University of Iowa. I'm the only member of the Institute for the Study of Mediocrity. It's just me. I'm studying it. So let's move on then. So this expands the size of these human groups and the level of cooperation within them, however measured. That is the creation of the bow and arrow. Then there's a kind of a natural experiment that you notice, and that is different rates of, we'll call it development. I don't know if that's a neutral term or not, or acceptable to most people. We'll call it development, between the Americas and Eurasia. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so let's divide that in two parts. So Mesoamerica and South America are one story. North America is the second story, probably having to do with the climate barriers in the Southwest. So the bow actually is invented in North Africa. It spreads across Eurasia, and in its wake, I say again, in its immediate wake, there are a whole set of agricultural revolutions, including the ones we know about in the Middle East, for example, producing wheat and barley and pigs and cows and things. Another set in East Asia, a few thousand years later, immediately after the coming of the bow, producing millet and several different rice variants. Then the bow apparently slowly spreads over the pole and into North America. And in fact, it doesn't come to North America until about 400 A.D., very recent. And in its immediate wake, I say again, in its immediate wake, you get this massive florescence of Neolithic cultures, including, of course, the two famous cases, the Mississippians in your neck of the woods,
mm-hmm.
and the Anasazi in present-day New Mexico and Utah and so on. So that's a very striking temporal displacement. North America is 10,000 years behind Neolithic Eurasia, but they are exactly in step with the coercive technologies that they possess.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, I see. So,
am I addressing your question, Marshall?
Yeah, no, that was exactly right. What is the story with Central and South America then?
Yeah, so that's a much more interesting, much more complex story. We believe that the bow does not come there until late. And so there are two parts to that story. Behaviorally modern humans do domesticate plants, rarely, but they do. And it looks like behaviorally modern humans in Meso and or South America domesticated a strain of cotton, which in turn produced the ability to generate elite woven garments.
Mm-hmm.
They eventually produced elite body armor.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, the Aztecs were using quilted cotton body armor, kind of like Kevlar, at the time of their engagement with the conquistadors in
mm-hmm.
the 16th century. That body armor creates the ability to produce elite armored warriors.
Mm-hmm.
It creates individuals who are refractory to the available projectile weapons, the bow or the outlaw, for example. And those elite individuals then police conflicts of interest for the society as a whole, creating what we call an archaic state.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that's the trajectory in Mesoamerica. There's a lot of evidence. We can talk about the archaeology if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But, the downside of that, Joanne was starting to allude to a moment ago, is that humans project self-interest not in the common good, but in pursuit of self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
These elite males, whether they be Roman legionnaires or Aztec or Inca warriors, of course, are creating societies that serve elite male interests, not everyone's interests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
One of the important things to remember is that, honest theory, human history, for the most part, because threat was democratically distributed, was mostly very democratic. In other words, women and men, most men, could protect their interests, their individual interests, equally.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get into the archaic state and you have elite body armor, what tends to happen there is that's no longer the case. There's a tremendous opportunity cost to use this body armor. And women start to become subjected at that point, and so are non-elite men.
Mm-hmm.
So this falls right along the theory as far as it being individual self-interest that matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
And if it was for the group benefit, then it wouldn't turn out that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course this is particularly important, even though this is a transient blip in the 2-million-year Herman story. It's particularly important because, of course, archaic states invent written language. And so our written history appears to start in what looks like a hierarchical male-dominated situation. a lot of biologists and social scientists alike have made the mistake of assuming that that is the ancestral human condition. It's very unlikely that it is.
No, yeah, that's true. Almost, you can kind of see that in our morphology, but we won't go into that. So let's move on to the next weapon system, and that is gunpowder weapons. They have a very interesting history. Go ahead.
Yeah. So there's actually a large body of military history that I think you could comment better than I, but I have the impression that a lot of mainstream historians kind of ignore military history. And the military historians have been telling us for at least 75 years that there's an intimate connection between gunpowder and the rise of the modern state.
No question about it.
Yeah, and our theory actually predicts that. And we predict that that happens in two stages, Marshall. The first stage is artillery. Even though it's a big, heavy weapon, it's technically very easy to make. And so artillery is developed in Western Europe from imported East Asian gunpowder, probably the middle of the 14th to the middle of the 15th century. And the early modern state follows from that. So these large weapons, of which artillery is the first example, are no longer individual weapons. The use of the weapon is itself a social enterprise. So the effect of the weapon is determined by who controls it, and that in turn is determined by who controls individual coercive threat. So these early weapons are developed in the context of the late archaic state in which armored warriors, elite males, are still the dominant force.
Mm-hmm.
So the France of Louis XIV had heavily armed nobilities fielding gunpowder artillery.
Mm-hmm.
That produces a new scale of social cooperation because the early modern states are more stable and larger than archaic states. But it's a fairly puny increase in adaptive sophistication. The big pop from gunpowder comes with the second development of technically more demanding but small weapons, individual gunpowder weapons, handguns. Those are developed in the 17th century, and in the immediate wake of those, they're developed in Western Europe, and in their immediate wake, we have the Democratic Revolutions, the Glorious Revolution in the UK, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. Those result, these weapons have the ability to penetrate any body armor that's technically feasible, and as a result, they chase elite warriors from the field.
Mm-hmm.
Now, human societies, including big social weapons like artillery, are controlled by whoever controls these weapons. So in cultures where these weapons are democratically distributed, so Western Europe, North America are conspicuous examples, the modern democratic state arises.
Mm-hmm.
This is a colossally huge adaptive revolution because you're now taking this ancient 2-million-year-old human trick of cooperation, democratic cooperation, and instead of doing it on the scale of hundreds or thousands, you're now doing it on the scale of tens of millions. And the scaling effect is spectacular. It produces a scientific revolution, the modern economic miracle, and a whole set of other interesting effects.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of the expression, God didn't make all men equal, Sam Colt did. Do you know that?
Yeah. And you're probably aware that the Russians either ripped that off or at least unconsciously arrived at the same thing. The Russians have a saying, God made men...
God made people.
And Kalashnikov made them equal.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, it's quite true. So we're a little bit short on time here, and so I want to get from the gun and the Democratic Revolution to nuclear weapons, which seem in a way to be perhaps the, I don't know, it seems as if almost the end of this trajectory.
Go ahead and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we would argue that nuclear hyperexplosives are less of a qualitative difference than we sometimes think.
Mm-hmm.
We're already, even with conventional weapons, in possession of the technology to burn a city to the ground,
mm-hmm.
right? Witness Hamburg or Dresden in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we would argue that it's that capacity, the capacity to seize control of the air and crush a nation state as by a coalition of other nation states.
Okay.
That is fundamental logic. Whether you use nuclear weapons or conventional hyperexplosives is secondary.
Mm-hmm.
But that effect then allows law enforcement on a planetary scale. And we would argue that the contemporary emergence of the human village, the pan-global human village, is in fact a consequence of that. Nation states have a different relationship now than they had 75 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're very good at recognizing credible threat. So in other words, those nuclear weapons were used. Everybody wants them. It becomes almost like a standoff at that point,
mm-hmm.
because no one will use them because they know everyone else will use them against them.
Yeah, the old Mexican standoff. That's what it is. Yeah, everybody's got a gun to everybody else's head. So they're pretty useless as instruments and strategy.
Oh, they're not useless. Remember that a policeman almost never fires his gun.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if there are no bullets in the gun, law enforcement doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
fact, these global weapons have that same underlying logic. The only time we would ever use them is if an individual nation state got completely off the reservation, like Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we possess them, no nation state is going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost like we tend to forget how much course of credible threat is part of our environment that we peacefully operate under. If you remove the threat, the peace goes away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think from your, yes.
If you take it one step further now with strategic weapons, in other words, now we have strategic weapons that will go in, and rather than punishing an entire civilization, it will go after the people that are responsible. So this is part of what a democratic innovation, I would like to say, actually creates, because democratic coalitions tend to be much more humane.
Mm-hmm.
So here we're not going to look to punish individual citizens of a state. Instead, we're going to go after who it is that's responsible for the problem in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So a future conversation for us to have is the relationship between hierarchical and democratized mm-hmm. cultures and military aggression, Marshall. It's a very interesting topic. I think it's beyond our scope today, but a very interesting
topic. Well, I wanted to ask, you know, I'm a little bit old school about these things. I don't know about you, but good theories, good scientific theories should not only explain, but they should, as you said, actually predict.
Yep.
And if that is the case, then what is next according to the lights of your theory?
Well, I think we have reasonable confidence that the trajectory will be as follows, that the pan-global cooperation will continue to increase, that is, the fraction of economic activity that is international will continue to increase. That's easy. The challenge is the struggle between hierarchical polities and democratized polities. If you look at per capita GDP, the correlation between authentic democracy, I don't mean faux paper democracy, I mean authentic democracy, which is democratic distribution of access to coercive threat, the correlation between authentic democracy and economic and scientific productivity is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
So the per capita GDP of North Korea, for example, is 20-fold lower than South Korea, to take one mm-hmm. sort of conspicuous example. So our other challenge is to democratize the remaining non-democratic states. North Korea, Iran are enormous challenges and obvious ones, but China and Russia remain.
Mm-hmm.
People focus on the Chinese growth rate. That's a mistake. Their per capita GDP is still abysmal. And working as a global coalition to enforce this, patiently enforce the democratization of those states, is something we must do. It is something I think that we will do. And when we do it, the consequences for our grandchildren will be spectacular. A global population of 6 billion democratized humans is an unbelievably powerful thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Joanne, do you want to add to that?
Well, what I would add to that is that we, I guess the most important piece of that is this understanding that when you have an entrenched elite, it is very difficult for democracy to merge under it. So the big question for us is how to protect a fledgling democracy or a social group that's coming to be a democracy from the outside without overpowering, number one, and without letting other elites take over in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard because you have an entrenched power already in place, and it's very difficult because it's not cost-effective for the individuals to take over that state if they don't have coercive threat already.
I think we could have an entire hour conversation about this. We have a lot of very detailed thoughts, but there are straightforward ways to do this. We know it works. Nazi
mm-hmm.
Germany and Imperial Japan are examples. The problem is the costs were high.
Uh-huh.
The trick is to do it more cheaply, and we have some very good ideas about how to do that. And coming back to predictions about the future, we believe that the power, economic and intellectual, of democratized states will ultimately overpower the non-democratic states, and this will happen. The question is how fast.
Mm-hmm. Well, from your lips to God's ears, as they say, we've taken an absolutely huge amount of your time. I could talk about this for another hour easily, but I feel that we have to kind of close. So let me ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and I will ask it in the opposite order I began the biographies with. What are you working on now, Paul?
Well, so the other half of my life has now become about cancer research, and we were developing a new approach to cancer chemotherapy that we think has enormous promise, and we've recruited a corporate collaborator in Cornerstone Pharmaceuticals to help us with that. That's exciting. But I'm equally excited about what Joanne and I are doing, equally excited about it. We've developed world-class expertise in online instruction, and we're learning to teach this content, the content of the book, to a global audience, including currently North American and British students, and we hope to expand that. And then we're also planning the next book that grows naturally from this one on theories of institutions, but I think I'll leave it to Joanne to talk about that.
Okay, Joanne, go ahead.
Yes, it's very important as far as I'm concerned for theories of institutions because this is the environment that we live and operate in every day in our public life. And those institutions need to be serving our interests rather than just some elites. And some institutions that we have today, that's not necessarily the case. So to understand what's going on and how to change it, I think is very important to just not only innovation, but to our everyday life and the happiness that we get from it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have you on the show again when you're done with the next big project, and maybe we'll talk for 2 hours then. I'd really like to thank you both for writing the book. It's absolutely terrifically interesting, and I think that it should be widely read. I really hope that it will be. I want to see a return to this kind of what I would call analytic theories of history as opposed to some other kinds. I guess I put my cards on the table there. And again, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Bingham and Joanne Souza about their new book, Death from a Distance and the Birth of a Humane Universe. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.